A lot of people forget this, but there's inherent reasons why English is just an easier language for algorithms. And like, very simple one. The alphabet is relatively short. There's only 26 letters. Other languages tend to have way more, if you think about it. All the different accents and that kind of a thing. And because all the accents of these languages, your vocabulary is bigger, which also means your neural network's got to be bigger, which also means you got to wait longer before the training procedure is done. All sorts of these things that we can only unravel, unpack, and tackle if we take a more global, open approach.
Welcome to the Tangible Computing Podcast. My name is Andrew Rutgers, co-host.
And I'm Gareth Thomas.
The Tangible Computing Podcast is about where computing meets the real world. From the fast and complex, like controlling an engine, to imaging a patient or scheduling an airline. We want to trigger your curiosity by talking to the people behind the scenes of making the modern world happen, deepening your understanding of where computation plays a role in our everyday lives and motivating you to help engineer a better world. This episode of Tangible Computing is brought to you by ChargeSim. ChargeSim is helping accelerate the transition to electric vehicles by helping electric vehicle fleets find the right charging infrastructure for their needs, trading off parking arrangements, smart charging, and utility capacity to help find the most cost-effective solution. And now, let's find out how software drives the world. Welcome to the Tangible Computing Podcast. I'm Andrew Rutgers, and today we're interviewing Vincent Varmerdam, who is a research advocate at RASA. So to start off, Vincent, can you tell us a fun fact about yourself?
It seems that there's a photo of me at a conference, PyData Berlin, I think 2017. I'm basically presenting this slide saying, hey, I do Hadoop, Vulpix, Onyx, Spark, and then I have a slide that says, I hope recruiters can understand that there's a difference between Pokemon and big data technology. That photo got turned into a meme. That meme has been growing exponentially ever since. It's now nearly 5 years later, and I've been invited to go to speak as a keynote speaker at technical recruitment events as a result. Nice. Fun fact, I'm a tech meme for recruiters.
Okay, and I have actually heard that meme and seriously considered using it myself, because yeah, there are any number of kind of silly named packages and things that recruiters tend to be looking for. Also, Pokemons. Recruiters may also be looking for Pokemons, but that's a side thing.
At some point, I was approached by, I believe he was a pro Pokemon Go player, like someone who was actually trying to collect all of them, and he was having trouble finding Snorlax.
He was asking he was like, do you know where to find this? Is there a GitHub repository where I could, you know, get a Snorlax? Yeah, so okay.
And also I learned that Snorlax in French is Ronflex. They translate their Pokemon there. That's not a joke.
Oh, interesting. I guess it makes sense because there is a bit of a word in there that you get a hint of what's going on. Interesting.
So I don't know. I'm also a meme. I'm also known for other things. But fun fact, I'm also a meme that gets me into recruitment podcasts once in a while as well.
Okay. And do you enjoy dealing with recruiters?
I'm really privileged in this sense, but I have never been hired through a recruiter before. Like, it just never happened. So far in my career, I've only been hired directly via the CTO, where the CTO basically came up to me after a talk I did at a conference or read one of my blog posts and said, hey, you seem to know your stuff about this phenomenon. We are looking for someone like that. And that's how I've always been hired. I want to be careful because there are also lots of good recruiters out there who are just trying to find someone for a meaningful role. And also what I want to be careful of is I am quite privileged with a lot of luck I had in my career. Not everyone is as lucky, and a lot of people do want to find jobs. So I don't want to be the guy who stands on stage going, it's so easy, recruiters, but like, that's productive. I am, however, representing a meme. So this is also the story I tell whenever I'm talking about the meme.
And a meme is a way to help figure out the good recruiters from the maybe not so with it recruiters. Yeah. So, go ahead.
So to be honest, I have actually found like a small site track, and then we'll go back. But one thing I've noticed, if you put your buzzword bingo, as I would say, like on your LinkedIn page, that is how they will find you. Yeah. And I blame any recruiter for getting the assignment of finding people who know scikit-learn, and then, hey, a person who knows scikit-learn, that's how you get found. So the simple thing is, if you don't want to have those kinds of interactions, the simple thing to do is just remove scikit-learn from your profile. The downside then is you won't be found either.
I can also understand it. Like if I think about playing the hiring manager when I'm looking to recruit
And I don't have the time to dig through all the profiles myself, so you deal with a recruiter. And then the recruiters, they want some instructions about what you want. And of course you say, oh, I want someone brilliant and super talented in programming with a really strong abstract knowledge. But the funny thing is that's just very difficult to figure out from a LinkedIn profile. And as the person employing the recruiter to find someone, you then need to get a couple buzzwords. They better know some Python and they better know some scikit-learn and their skills with a Vulpix, that's a separate topic. That's a Pokemon. But then, yeah, you got to give them something to work with.
But then the lesson on my end, at least, like referring to the Pokemon thing, the moment that I removed the Pokemon, like all of them from my LinkedIn profile, it was also the moment that the interactions with recruiters did become a little bit more meaningful. Because then the recruiters started finding me because I did a PyData talk or because of something I wrote down on my blog. Another thing I typically do is like on LinkedIn, it literally says, if you have interesting problems, just call me. It's fine. I'll have a coffee with you for half an hour just to give my advice. And that, like many meaningful interactions do come from that.
Yeah, it's a nice way to get out there and get engaged with interesting problems. I think that's probably also for developers that are looking to jump into a higher level work towards CTO level, like I think you've been doing, that's probably also a way to do it, is just being open to problems and discussing them with other people and that kind of approach.
Possibly. I don't know. So for starters, I don't know if I actually have the ambition to become a CTO, but another thing is also, I also have to admit that I've been lucky and privileged because I was one of the people who was running PyData Amsterdam, but also my role was that I was quite visibly the person running PyData Amsterdam. It was like totally a group effort, but a lot of people somehow remember me. And so that makes me an easy person to find. If you decide one day, hey, I also want to do that, people still have to find
you. So and it takes a while to build that reputation up. That's not an overnight thing.
Yes. So start your blog early is the only advice I might have there. But it takes a while. Like, really, I've been doing this for 10 years.
That's a good one to keep in mind because you are fairly high profile, having organized the conference, the PyData conference, other things like that. But then that does take 10 years. And I certainly know for myself, my first job came because I was doing solar powered car racing in undergraduate and just... So for some reason, when I got out of school, I was different than just every other graduate. And that uniqueness opened some, it meant I wasn't a fit for a lot of places, but it opened some really cool doors. Mm. And I think you're probably in a similar one, that it being more visible, you open a certain set of doors that gets you into some interesting stuff. So cool.
Yeah. And a final thing, if anyone is like thinking like, oh, I want to have a career path, like the only advice I might have is don't underestimate how random career paths can be.
Oh, yeah.
So like one thing I genuinely, like looking back at everything, people seem to like my talks at PyData, but I think I had the best training ever because when I was in college, I was a bartender at the local theater. So like every Dutch comedian I saw on stage because that was part of my job. And doing that for 3 years, I do think that must have had an impact on my presentation skills.
Yeah.
Like it's bound to. But no one would advise you if you're going into tech to be a bartender at a local theater. But in hindsight, I would argue it's been a huge boon to my career.
So, and I think it also depends on the role you want in tech. Certainly for the more public facing, like you're a research advocate, that is much more public facing. And there the speaking part is a huge element of it.
Yeah. Yep. No, that's definitely true.
To jump in, what you work for Raza, and can you tell us a little bit about what they do and what big problem are you solving?
The preferred terminology is virtual assistants. You can call it a chatbot, but we like to think assistants a bit more broader and more specific to what we try to do. But the idea is, you know, at some point in time, you're actually going to get meaningful virtual assistants out there. And the main thing we really want to do is just automate some of the boring stuff through a conversational interface. My mom, she might not be able to program, but it would still be nice if she can schedule a booking with an agent somewhere or something like that. We like to think that doing that with like natural language is a very natural way to go. So we are trying to make the technologies in an open source way such that anyone can just build their own virtual assistant. So it's like Elasticsearch. They had this vision of what a search engine could be, and they open sourced their vision for that. There's some enterprise stuff built on top of it. We're trying to do the very same thing, but with virtual assistants. So you want your chatbot on Facebook, we've got a plugin for that. You want it on WhatsApp, we have an integration for that. And we have all sorts of models for machine learning as well, such that you don't have to worry about some of the nasty bits. That's one of the overarching things that we provide.
So what are the, I'll be blunt, I generally dislike chatbots. I generally find their accuracy is at this low enough to be annoying. And this is, I think, one of the big challenges in AI is there's certain types of problems where you have to get a high enough hit rate to not be annoying or not be destructive to the process. But So first off, what sort of hit rates do you see? Like, how good can chatbots be now?
So there's a couple of things to unpack there. So I agree. Like, I've interacted with a very annoying chatbot before, and it is annoying. Like, it is, period. But then if you unbundle that, what's the annoying part? It's probably not like the intent classification scores or the recall or the precision or the ROC curve. Like, it's probably not that. However, what might be the case is that, hey, I have an intent that I would like this chatbot to fulfill. I have a very specific FAQ question or something like that. And there's just no response for that specific question.
Yeah.
So it could be that the assistant is designed to handle 50% of all requests coming in, which might just be one of 10 questions, but it might be that there's still 10 missing. And if you want to figure that out, that's more of a labeling issue and a data quality kind of a thing, like how do you get your feedback in order, than necessarily an algorithmic one. I'm mentioning this because you used the word accuracy there. I don't think it's an accuracy problem. I think it's a shortage of intents problem there.
Right. So it's you do a quick job of the chat, of programming up the chat bot, but you haven't put enough in it that it's not able to help long enough. I think that's probably also a little bit of a long tail question, that the number of possible interactions you're going to have with a company calling the technical support, there can be an enormous number of very varied and weird and very rare things. My cat got stuck under your machine. It's probably not one that you want to have a web form for. What animal got caught in what system?
How many tomatoes are actually in that can of tomato soup?
Yeah, and somebody probably has a reason why they want to know this and that they're going to go to the trouble of asking it. But having your chatbot program to immediately recognize it's probably... Yeah, probably.
But also, and when you realize this, though, like here comes then the question, okay, how do you deal with this then? So a couple of ground rules are, it will be good if the assistant never pretends to be a human, like never design a chatbot that way, like that would be bad. And second, it would be nice if the assistant is also always able to get you to a human agent instead. Right? Let's start there. Those are like good ground rules, so to say. And from there, a lot of it is just listening to what users are using your assistant for. And part of that is because the new iPhone might come out. And when it does, people are just going to ask different questions than they were today. But the only way to really be on top of that, you got to accept the world's changing. So you got to look at those logs.
And so that's probably if a company does a one-shot implementation and says, yeah, our team thought that these were the 10 questions that would come up the most. And so we programmed these in and everything else, we have no idea. Then it's going to be a problem, as opposed to taking, we're looking at the logs, we're getting all the information, and then we are iterating on it and adding a new question it can answer every week.
Yeah, so I hear stories of like some of the companies who seem to be doing this better. They tend to have every week we're doing a new labeling round, and they just try to every week have another hypothesis. What are we missing this week? The thing going. The one aspect about this that makes it super hard, though, is that not just are we dealing with the fact that we're typically behind what our users might want, it's also that they're using natural language. And good grief, natural language is super hard. And the best example of this, and this is also like one of the core problems in this field, very typically what people would do is they would say, let's have an intent for hello. And then for hello, there's a couple of ways of saying hello. You could say hi there, greeting. And for saying goodbye, you can say, cheerio, goodbye. And you could say that's a classification problem. You go from text, you then have an intent, and then you reply with an action that's attached to that intent.
But depending where I say good evening in a conversation, I could mean I'm happy to see you or piss off.
Or, and also it can mean hello or goodbye.
Yeah.
And the thing is, those are two opposite meanings using the same text. What we are noticing over at Raza is that intents are just maybe not the right abstraction. So intents are useful, right? Especially when you're getting started, they give a lot of structure. But natural language isn't done in intents. If, for example, I'm a virtual agent and I ask you like, hey, what do you want to eat? Do you want to eat sushi? And the user says, I had that yesterday. Then I had that yesterday doesn't mean no. Only in the context of this conversation does it mean no.
And this is where the smart bartender, server, whatever may come up and say, we have a really interesting sushi that's probably very different from the one that you had yesterday on special. Or they may say, okay, fine. Did you want the noodles?
Or what about Mexican or what have you?
Yeah.
But this is the harder part. Like getting the intents, grabbing the intents, stuff about that. That's as long as you follow the rules, just keep on labeling every week, you can get it a long way. But then on the algorithmic side, you're still dealing with natural language, and natural language is just hard. Another thing that we've also sometimes heard, you hear interesting war stories. So there's also some of these virtual assistants, the user interface can be confusing to end users. So some people think, I have to say hello first, and then we have the conversation. And other people think, no, I should just type 16 paragraphs into this text box, hit enter, and then I'll get like all the text back.
There's also
a user interface here.
And I tend to do it the way I would do a Google search, that I know that I'm going to type keywords. I know you can type a full question in, and sometimes that can actually work better. But a lot of the time, it's just like keywords, account address update. And it's not natural language. It's unnatural language. And you also probably have to deal with people like me.
And I also have to deal with you in Spanish.
Right.
Braza should also support basically every, like, a lot of NLP is hyper-focused on English. It's actually annoying. So we also want Braza to work on non-English. And there's all sorts of interesting sub-problems, and let's not underestimate how much the user interface matters here. There's also systems you can build on top of this that actually use voice, which also introduces a couple of extra challenges there. But so basically what we're trying to do with Braza is just give you some of the tools and the infrastructure to just do this in production. And it's the core part of it, like all the machine learning stuff, all of that is like super open source. You can build your own models. We provide some that we like to think are just super useful. But just like Elasticsearch, we're trying to be the infrastructure layer there a bit. That's the dream that is currently implementing.
So what, I mean, the other way, if I think about it as a web developer, I'd say by changing my address for my account, I could implement a form to do that. And I'd have a little tree of, do you want to change your address? Do you want to update this information? Do you want to update that? And then the other option is I could do the chatbot. What are the trade-offs of doing one or the other? And I'm thinking both in sort of usability and also in the developer experience of what's faster or what's easier to implement.
You have a very similar thing happening with FAQ questions, right? When is an FAQ question better than a virtual assistant? So one thing I like to think of is sometimes navigation is an issue. So like you have a submenu and a submenu, and inside of that, there's a button and that thing has to be pressed. So there are a couple of really cool banking apps in the United States where if you want to change a setting, what the main thing that the virtual agent will do is just bring you the right button.
Yeah. And if you have a very simple site with sort of 10 things or something, the navigation is probably not that big a deal. But yeah, if you're a bank and you have all sorts of different types of customers, it could be that you have forms for, I don't know, 100 different interactions that you might regularly have with the bank, especially you get into corporate clients and then stuff gets really weird and complicated. And just finding the right one could be really helpful.
There's that, but there's also this other element if you've ever filled in, so this is an implementation thing of Braza, but let's say you filled in a form before and we know your address, we know your name. And let's say there's another form where we also need to know your address and your name, but also your phone number. Typically a form in the web browser needs to remember all of those items for you. The site itself typically cannot pre-fill that in. So there's also some of these like UI things you can just do differently. For example, we can also generate buttons inside of a text prompt as a quick link to something. That is also something forms typically have a little bit of trouble with in order for them to be intuitive. But another thing is also what you can also do is if let's say you do it by voice. We have voice integrations with different platforms. But you can also do something like, hey, hello, my name is Vincent. This is my address. Just in one sentence. And then it's up to us to parse all of the information from that. That's also something that forms don't necessarily allow because you have to click the missing element.
Autofill it can get reasonably quick, but it's not perfect. It's not great sometimes. So
well, and it's also on mobile, right? That's also the thing. Or if you're on Facebook or what have you. If I think about customer support on Twitter, often if the company has customer support on Twitter, it's quite likable. It's just direct. I don't have to find the customer support portal on their website.
Right.
So there's also the fact that you can put it on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And then Facebook Messenger has it. And like those kinds of integrations also make sense.
Well, what's the development effort like? If I think about I could have a chatbot on Facebook versus I could have a form on my website. What I guess it's a really difficult question because a lot of it's around the back end side and what you're connecting to. But how do those look in terms of effort?
It depends a little bit on the scale as well. So if you have a bazillion users, you need to have your Kubernetes cluster. Okay, so then you're maintaining a Kubernetes cluster, which has all sorts of issues. It's just complex. It's manageable, but you're maintaining a cluster. Like the very simple thing, it's basically like a Flask-like app, if you think about it. It's just one that has a machine learning in it. And the main thing that Braza just has for you is just some config files where you can put your data in that's relatively easy to just add in. So if you have a sentence like, I want to buy a pizza, you can put square brackets around the pizza to indicate this is an entity that I want to detect. But basically, it's just a bunch of config files with training examples. And from there, Braza can just turn that into a web server.
And so an experienced person, they can implement that fairly quickly and add in new intents, new functionality fairly quick. Okay, interesting. It's not one I've ever played with so far, but yeah.
If I give the getting started workshop and I'm in front of a person who's already done Python a bit, it's an hour, and then you've built your first assistant from the command line that you can also turn into a web server. So it's not, the devil's a little bit more in the details when, for example, you have very complex entities to detect because natural language is tricky. And like the getting started is super easy, but the learning from your actual users, that usually takes a while because users are super complex. Like that's more the hard part.
You need to record a lot of these interactions, and I guess it's probably just the text. I could also be speaking, and then review it and decide, did this do what the customer wanted? Is this working properly? Are there other ways they're phrasing this, and figure out from there? Yeah.
Very simple. So a teenager uses your chatbot and says, yo, instead of hello. Okay. If you've never seen the word yo before, it's a really strange word. How am I supposed to respond to that? One thing I do think is interesting, and it's an area I would love to explore more. I have heard some stories where people are making Raza bots not for customer service, but more for internal use, like to automate some HR tasks. So think of, hey, I want to book my holidays, and we have this weird internal system with a REST API, and then they just write some custom functions attached at the Raza. That's now in Slack. And then suddenly HR, who has to manage thousands of users, can just get their form information via Slack.
Yeah. I do remember having a chatbot that it was required to reset passwords at a previous job. I will say that was about the only thing that it did, and it was not particularly remarkable at it. That had we just had a form that said reset your password, that probably would have been preferable. But
that could have, so in a lot of cases, like I've also written my own Slack bots once in a while. I like to write it for little things like, what provider do we use to expense bills? Some of these kinds of things. But the interesting thing here more is that you actually bring it closer. The person who's designing the assistant tends to be the person who's using it as well in these situations. And that, I think, is very interesting because the risk of an ivory tower is also way smaller that way. So you can also wonder...
Really close to the problem.
Yeah. So if one thing I think is an interesting like psychological experiment almost is, would it not maybe be more convenient if we have a virtual assistant just customized by one person for one person? Because I think the machine learning problem is going to be way easier.
Ooh, interesting. But then
there's something about that. That seems like a pretty good idea. It's just, how do you then hook up the backend?
Yeah. I think it's also in democratizing it that you need to make it easy and accessible enough for sort of non-specialists. If you're a programmer and you get this to jump on, well, I'm going to make a little chatbot to help myself. Yeah, okay, cool. And frankly, just about every software developer has a pile of little scripts and stuff they've done just to make their lives easier because they're fundamentally lazy, and automation is the way to reduce effort.
They have a pile of scripts on a pile of raspberries in their house.
Yeah, exactly. And this is all pretty normal. But then if you want to extend that to sort of non-programmers, then that's it needs to be a much easier, you need sort of low code for natural language processing.
Yeah, so there's definitely, but I think there's definitely some stuff there. But I should also mention, like, it's still relatively early days, I want to say. Like, how do you actually do virtual assistants? It's a lot of open questions. There's also like a lot of players and companies working on this problem. But the main thing that makes Raza unique is that we just say, look, the base of it just has to be open source. Yeah. Because otherwise, we cannot dream to support every language out there if it's closed source, because no one can build integrations.
No, you need the network effect building up all of the local and all of the specific language cases.
Yeah, and also, a lot of people forget this, but there's inherent reasons why English is just an easier language for algorithms. And like, very simple one, the alphabet is relatively short. There's only 26 letters. Other languages tend to have way more, if you think about it. All the different accents and that kind of a thing. And because all the accents are sometimes in one of these languages, your vocabulary is bigger, which also means your neural network's got to be bigger, which also means you got to wait longer before the training procedure is done. So all sorts of these things that we can only unravel, unpack, and tackle if we take a more global, open approach.
English tends to also break up words quite a bit, whereas like Dutch and German, even more so, tends to really lump them together. And so you end up with what in English would end up being three words or an acronym turns into one very long word.
I do know, like, if you could choose a language before you play Scrabble, the German would definitely beat the English guy, like, for sure. That said, though, Turkish is even longer. Turkish is just amazing. I think... It could be wrong, but I've had people tell me that the rules for Scrabble are different if you're playing in Turkish, because otherwise you can cheat. So you have to use a grammatical lemma when you put the word down, and without any sort of, so like the infinitive of the verb instead of every possible conjugation, because you can keep on stacking adverbs forever. But yeah, different languages are different. In Raza, we also use subword tokenizers precisely for this reason, such that if you have a morphologically rich language where a single word actually has like three words combined, you can still extract those features because we also extract subwords.
Mm-hmm. So this is then a specific or approach that's needed because you're dealing with a wide variety of languages as opposed to just focusing on one and the sort of narrower vocabulary needed.
Yeah. So the funny thing is this trick also is very useful for spelling errors, turns out. So you also want to have it for English for that reason. But I mean, when you go into word embeddings kinds of topics, it is nice to also just be able to say, look, if you've trained your word embeddings on the Dutch Wikipedia, you can also just add them in. Like that's also the thing that we should be caring about.
What size kind of functional vocabulary do you need for an effective chatbot?
It's hard to put a big number on it, but one thing I will say is there's only so many ways to order a pizza.
Your task vocabulary is actually comparatively small, that you would say, I want to order, I want it delivered, or send me a... And there's a handful of things that you would use for that, and the chances that a carburetor comes up in the conversation is really low.
Yeah. And also, if it doesn't understand the word carburetor, I might forgive the pizza bot for not understanding that.
I want a pizza at least the size of my carburetor.
Yeah. Oh, dang. We didn't catch that one. Well, so it depends. It is so determined on the use case. And also, if your assistant also needs to provide like a search bar, like we're going to search a database and it has a text query in it. Okay, technically your vocabulary can explode just because of that. But then you solve that by saying, if we are certain that we're in the context of search, the next thing the user says...
Right. We put in the search bar and we go to a very large database as opposed to our internal vocabulary. And then it may be that we have to parse out filler words or tell me about, as opposed to just carburetor, if let's say I'm ordering one at an auto parts store as opposed to the pizza joint.
Something tells me you work in the automotive industry, if I'm not mistaken.
I do. I was trying to think of an unusual word that I would be unlikely to use with a pizza. So how did you get into solving this? How do you become a research advocate at a machine learning company?
So first and foremost, natural language is not solved, right? It's not a solved problem at all. But the way I got the gig was non-standard. Basically what happened, and this is my version of the story. People will have different versions of this story. But a lot of it came down to I went to this conference called Spacey in Real Life. I was following this company called Explosion. I've always found them to be rather inspiring. They had an amazing blog. And then they had this NLP conference. And I thought it was great because I have never done NLP before in my life, before then. So I went to the conference, I spoke to the founders, and turns out that they were actually looking for someone to make YouTube videos for them because they wanted to grow their sort of presence and they needed like kind of person with a good accent, entertaining, to explain how Spacey works. And then we went to a bar, it was crowded, so we went to another bar. I went to the founder and I said, hey, this bar is way more Spacey. Apparently that joke did it. and they said, hey, maybe you would YouTube very well. We like this joke. They will tell you a different story, but this is how I remember it.
This talks about the randomness of career paths. Yeah. Had the first bar been had appropriate seating and decent cocktails, then you probably would have stayed there for a while and it just never would have come up.
Genuinely, because the thing is, it wouldn't surprise me too much because that I made. So the deal was I would make them videos and they would just teach me how to use Spacey. I basically figured if I'm going to be learning how to use Spacey, I'm currently learning it from the people who make it. So I went for it. They're also like Ines and Matt, great people, cool to hang out with. By every measure, I had a great time with them. But then I was also in Berlin occasionally for conferences. And then the founder of Raza reached out to me and said, hey, drop by the office because we like your blog. I dropped by. And we were talking a little bit about how hard it is to explain algorithms sometimes and what can you do against hype, all that. Turns out he was a fan of my blog, a fan of some of my open source projects. And then I told him, oh, by the way, I'm making these Spacey videos now. You should maybe check that out. And then he figured, oh, we need a Vincent, like someone who can just explain our complicated algorithms. It's what the Spacey people were also doing, just a more approachable way to teach machine learning. And in doing so, also teaching the tool. And then he figured that the easiest way to hire a Vincent was just to hire Vincent. And that's basically how I got the job. But a lot of that was random, I would say. And sure, I had a coding career before then, and that definitely helped because I can code. I'm a bit of a senior.
You need to understand the algorithms. You need to be able to build them yourself. But then the aim is also around being able to explain them and get other people to figure them out and be able to use your product and figure out how it might be useful for them.
Yeah, so but that so this actually got me the job, but if I think about what the job actually entails, we still don't really know. It's not a really formal description, but it's the main idea was, hey, we've got this developer community that's worldwide, we have complex algorithms and a research team, and we just want someone to sit in the middle and do useful stuff. So that also meant that I was free to start making plugins for Raza. So most of the non-English technology stuff you can use are in experimental plugins that I made on behalf of the research team. And there's also some stuff that the research team doesn't necessarily have time for because it's maybe not super high on the priority roadmap for whatever reason, that I can suddenly pick up because I can say, look, if it's relevant for the community, just give them. So non-English and spelling error support, that's been stuff I've been able to work on because that's some typically more community kind of issues than necessarily enterprise kinds of issues, so to say. So I've been able to cherry pick interesting problems on behalf of the research team by doing this. And that's what my role is. I'm partially a communicator, but also partially the developer experience person trying to figure out where the holes are that I can easily.
Well, what do you think? Nice. Yeah, no, it sounds like it. You get to chat with lots of people, get to think about the areas that are that attract your attention pretty easily. What's one of the more difficult algorithms you've had to explain?
I mean, by the time I've explained them, I no longer find them complex because I understand them. But
yeah, that's what's necessary to do that.
Yeah, I will say that there's definitely more complex algorithms out there. We have an algorithm called Diet inside of Raza. It's the dual intent and entity transformer. I think it's a really clever algorithm and actually made me excited about deep learning for a bit again. But the reason why that's relatively complex is because I made 3 videos explaining how Diet works. And after that, I had to make 4 other videos because inside a Diet, there's this neural network architecture called a transformer. And that actually, you need 4 videos to just explain why the thing works the way it does and why it kind of matters. It's also the most successful videos on YouTube I've made for Raza. If you don't know what transformers are, go to the algorithm whiteboard on YouTube. And you'll get 4 videos to just explain you how intuitively they work and also just some of the mathematical detail.
So what's the problem that the Diet algorithm solves?
Imagine a user says, it could be hello. It could also be, I want to buy a pizza. And one part of what we want to figure out is what's the next action going to be. But as input for that, we want to know what the user's intent is right now. Also, if there are entities in that sentence right now and the conversation so far. And then one step in that
so it's a conversational state.
Yeah, but there's a short. So the long-term state and short-term state. And in the short-term state, you want to know what's the current intent and what are the elements that the user just said that might be relevant. So in the case of I want to buy a pizza, then the intent I would say is purchase. Right, you want to purchase something, and specifically you want to buy a pizza, which let's say it is an entity of type product. Now, before Diet, the way that Raza would tackle this, it would say, I have one model for intents, and I've got this other model for entities. Fair enough. You can have highly specialized models. Some, like, that's logical. You could also at some point say, depending on the intents that you're using, certain entities might be more plausible. And the presence of a certain entity may also imply a certain intent. So it's a shame that those are two separate algorithms. Maybe you just want to have one algorithm where the signal from the entity can also influence the intent and vice versa. Maybe we can pick up more signal if we do that.
It may be that I go to a chatbot and I could say, I want to buy a pizza, but I could also say, I want to buy a house. But the next steps for buying a pizza and the next steps for buying a house may both involve an address, but be very different. And the whole path that the chatbot has to go down is really very heavily influenced by it.
Assuming there's a chatbot where you can both buy a pizza as well as a house. Yes.
I'm trying to think of the number of businesses that would be offering this diverse range of services, but yes.
Yeah, so it is always good to come up with a good example. Okay, let's say the word, you're a banking assistant and the word and credit card appears as an entity. So we know you're talking about a credit card. Okay, then we can already rule out a couple of FAQ kinds of questions. So just because that entity is in there. Okay, then that signal that can make our algorithms perform better. Like that, and there's like interesting algorithmic reasons why we've implemented it in a certain way. It's really hard to do multi-task learning if you think about it. Like this one has an entity recognition score that's different than how accuracy scores for intents work. How do you actually combine them? It's that combination that I think they've done really well. They basically combine, if you're not technical, you're going to think this is really boring, by the way, but they've combined a transformer architecture from Google with a star space architecture from Facebook. And the way they've merged it together, I think is just really nice. But yeah.
So what are some of the languages or the tools that you work with quite a bit now? You mentioned Python and you mentioned PyData, so I assume that's an important one. Are there other favorites or others that you're using regularly or interested in?
So that's the cool thing about being a research advocate. I can actually build half of the tools I use. So one thing that, like, if people are doing NLP stuff and you're used to scikit-learn, then there is this one package I made for Raza that you might find useful too. It's called What Lies. The idea is I wanted to figure out what lies inside of Wordim. So one part of the library is a visualization package to figure out what these pre-trained models are all about. But as a side effect, I've also implemented all of them for scikit-learn. So if you want to download the universal sentence encoder from Google, that's scikit-learn compatible now. Byte-pair embeddings from Wikipedia or fast text from Facebook or whatever Hugging Face is doing, like, I have scikit-learn compatible tools for that. And whenever I have a new data set and I just quickly want to explore what's in there, I find that's useful to have around. I've recently started working on this thing that some of the researchers are also enthusiastic about. It's called DoubtLab. That's a tool to find bad labels in data sets. So if we are going to be doing stuff in production and multiple people are actually labeling a data set, it is nice to have a couple of heuristics around, such that once in a while, you can check if there weren't any bad labels. And other than that, it's mainly the PyData stack though.
Do you see labeling as a major problem for machine learning?
I think the lack of labeling is a huge problem. If you are, it's great that you can flow a bunch of tensors and you know your algorithms and stuff, it's great. But if you don't look at your data regularly, you might also be disconnected from reality. And especially in the case of virtual assistants, if your users are complaining about something, you don't want three people between the person doing this in deployment and the person complaining. You would prefer that to be like a straight link. So I do think that the hard part in virtual assistants is more around labeling, I think, than do we have the best algorithm. That I am convinced of that.
A lot of the differentiation in the market is going to be on who has access to the largest and best labeled and most useful data sets, as opposed to just who comes up with the most brilliant algorithm, because whoever has the best data will be able to train the best algorithm.
Yes, in a way, yes. But I also think it's, suppose that you have a virtual assistant for IKEA. You're not going to be able to use that for Facebook because it's so domain specific, I think. Like, the questions people want to ask IKEA are so different than the questions people might want to ask whatever other store. That I also think, like, it's not necessarily about the biggest data set. It's more about how can you get the best data for your use case as an organization? And how can we make that part of that story has to be labeling. So what tools can we actually make that stuff as easy as possible? So one of the fancier algorithms we've made recently is called the unexpected intent policy detector. Basically, that detects conversations where something weird happens, something that the assistant has never seen before. So, like, someone starts a conversation by saying goodbye. Can we surface those conversations first? So those get labeled first. Like, these are kinds of algorithms that we're working on a lot these days.
So it's not necessarily the labeling, perhaps you have the humans doing it, but if you can identify the conversations and the data chunks that will have, that if they are properly labeled, they will have the most influence, most beneficial influence on your outcomes.
Yes, yes. So, and how can we make it easier for people to spend more time labeling the most important things? Like, that's a lot of research effort is going to go into that problem this year. I can safely say that.
Yeah, because another 10 labeled conversations that are exactly the same flow as the generic ones don't add a lot of value, and the learning happens in these obscure ones.
And what do you
think's overhyped at the moment?
What Pokemon name shall I mention? A bunch. And so I think there's two things that are a bit overhyped. So, like, one thing I think is a bit overhyped is this idea that you can automate machine learning. AutoML is something you hear people say sometimes, right? I get where it comes from. Like, doing grid search is not inherently a bad idea, but it does distract you away from reality. So I think I can say this somewhat generally about machine learning. Typically, you have a real problem in the real world, and then you translate that into an analytical problem. You then do your grid search, your TensorFlow, or what have you. And you get like a 5% performance on predicting. And that's great. But the question is that 5% going to translate back into reality, or is there maybe a mismatch of sorts? And if you're the kind of person who goes, AutoML, it's great, then you're never asking the question, like, gee, what am I losing in this translation over here? Because the only thing you're going to be focusing in on is that one little performance number, which is a huge dimensionality reduction of what's happening out there in the real world.
So really there you're... Yeah, to try and do the automated machine learning, you need to generate very large amounts of, you need to have very large amounts of data to try to optimize that. And that is, in some sense, that is a model of the real world. And so now you could be optimizing to the wrong parameters and knowledge of actually...
If you go to this website, labelerrors.com, it is amazing. It's a really fun website to visit. They show some of the most commonly used benchmarking data sets, and they just show some bad labels that are in there. So you see like a normal panda that's labeled as a red panda, for example. Like there's a research paper attached to that where they estimate that I think the Amazon reviews data set has like a 2% label error. If your state-of-the-art model performs 1% better, is that because it's overfitting on the bad labels, or is that because it's an actually better model? If there's label errors, you don't know. And that's what I mean with I'm kind of afraid for AutoML. You might be optimizing the wrong thing, and you don't know unless you actually start doubting what you're doing. And that's more qualitative, I think. And that's something that I would love to see more of.
And it requires that kind of domain knowledge and also, frankly, the hard work of getting the results, going back and checking them against reality and making sure that it actually makes sense. And accepting the fact that in many cases, you're not going to have a absolute perfect test set to work with, that we can sit here and have a conversation and then understand different things out of the conversation. Even though we're both humans and fairly capable at English, it can still happen. And so expecting a machine to perform better than that is going to be difficult.
Yeah, so totally. And yeah, sarcasm detection is like one of the harder problems in NLP at the moment. And detecting sarcasm is hard. Detecting sentiments or intents are also super hard. We don't have too much sarcasm in virtual sim, thankfully. But if something's a bit overrated, I would definitely go to the AutoML kind of space. Like it feels you can get by with simpler models most of the time. You don't need to flow that many tensors. That's my perspective there.
Yeah, so the number of people that say, look, I'm looking for someone to burn my pizza is relatively low, and the need for a burnt instruction to the chef is probably unlikely. That's probably sarcasm. What are you going to learn now?
It depends a little bit on what sort of the users are telling the chatbots these days, of course. But there are like a couple of things that I'm currently working on. So in general, my main thing that's interesting is like, when do systems fail and can we understand that? And one of the things that I have found is that a lot of NLP algorithms are really brittle when it comes to spelling. So not going into too much depth, but usually an English sentence is split up into separate words. And then every word is indexed, and that's how we get like a numeric representation for a word. And if a single character is different, the word's different. And especially on a mobile phone, I have fat fingers whenever I'm typing.
It seems like autocorrect is... and spelling checkers are fairly well developed, but then you need to decide, is this a spelling mistake or is this someone's last name?
That's the thing. I remember way back, I used to do a little bit of consulting for Marktplaats, like Dutch eBay. I remember there are so many ways to spell barbecue, and the search engine still has to work. And the same thing you have with virtual assistants. And one thing about spelling errors, not every spelling correction tool is perfect. That's something you got to keep in the back of your mind as well, especially in non-English, because what you get in non-English are things like accents on the E. So keeping that in mind, like spelling errors are like inherently an interesting problem, because one thing you could do is you could say, we can simulate some of these spelling errors. You could grab your keyboard, look at it, the H is next to the J. So that typo is more likely than from H to Q. Like it's a longer distance, so that's probably not going to happen. So we can simulate spelling errors, or some of them. Like phonetic spelling errors, you can't simulate this way, but at least the typo ones you can. And then you can train on that. Turns out you can actually, I've been able to demonstrate with some experiments that you can also get like better validation scores in general if you do this. So that's super interesting. The only downside is your vocabulary just explodes because you're introducing all these extra characters. And that can take a 15-minute training time to 90 minutes. Okay, so how do you deal with that? Then you've got hashing tricks. But this is the thing that I'm trying to dive a little bit deeper on. And also one thing I'm trying to unravel is just how often do these typos actually happen? It's one thing to solve the problem, but I want to figure out how big this problem is and if that's related to the language.
There's also a bit that my computer even does autocorrect. So then if I am talking to a chatbot, there's a fairly good chance that the OS has already thrown in some kind of spell checking anyway.
I would certainly hope so. But can we assume that on Slack, Facebook Messenger, WhatsApp, and every web browser? In every language.
So it's possible that it's there, it's possible that it's not, and even worse, it's possible that the autocorrect has kicked in and changed something to something completely different without us recognizing it, and so we're asking a ridiculous question.
Yeah, and you've also got these, it's not really the same as a spelling error, but when you do text speech-to-text, there's usually also errors involved in that. So how can we be robust against like token being misspelled? Like how bad is it if one word in a sentence is coming out wrong? There's brittleness there. That's the main thing I'm trying to dive into a bit more. What are the brittle elements? Can we like properly identify them so we have name attached? And can we then also say, this is the way you solve it? It turns out a lot of that involves labeling. It's
I would imagine, yeah. You got to look at a lot of spelling mistakes and yeah. So how can people reach out?
There's a bunch of places you can find me on the internet these days, but let's start with Twitter. My name is Vincent and Fishnets88 is my handle. I'm the guy in the ball pit in the photo. Then you can find me. You can also look for Vincent Wormadam on LinkedIn. I also respond there. Also guy in the ball pit. I have a blog at Koning.io. People sometimes reach out to me on that. And there's also like an educational project called CalmCode.io. Some people know me from that. People can also reach out to me there. If you want to make a virtual assistant for yourself, please do consider Araza. And if you think that you've found something that's broken, but in an interesting machine learning way, people can always just reach out to me. Like that's definitely within my realm of interest to know about, especially if it's non-English, by the way, to all you Dutch speakers out there. Non-English is really interesting for me.
This is a great place to stop our conversation today. I wanted to thank you for listening to Tangible Computing. While we have your attention, we really want this podcast to trigger your curiosity and motivate you to engineer a better world. So let us know if you have any ideas for future topics or speakers or how to make this podcast better. Send an email to tangible@tangiblecomputing.com.